Hello, I'm Christian Corley, and with me is James McLean, and you are listening to the Castovers podcast with a K, and we are here to have a chat with you about the latest episode of Doctor Who, Kablam! And some Doctor Who news as well, which we'll start off with. How are you doing, James?
Yeah, I'm all right. Yourself?
Yeah, grand. Not bad, thank you. Yeah, nearly Christmas, so obviously all that stuff's going on. And yeah, it's strange. It feels quite a distance to Christmas, but I'm told it's not that far. I'm told it's like 5 weeks.
Yeah, I just don't think about it. I literally go by the week, and I don't dare look beyond the week.
Yeah, we went to the Lego store yesterday, and were given a Lego catalogue. And that's one of those things I absolutely adored when I was a kid, was a Lego, product guide of all the stuff that was coming out.
Because they're very nice situated sort of double spreads, didn't they?
Yeah. So, this is far bigger. This is like an Argos catalogue version almost, but it's still some nice scenes in there and everything. So that's kind of got me, because Lego was a big thing at Christmas when I was a wee lad. But anyway, I digress. Doctor Who Series 12, which I kind of think might have come along because people have been more vocal than they would have been about the Doctor Who Christmas episode, which isn't going to be on Christmas, it's going to be on New Year's Day.
Possibly.
And I think they've confirmed it, haven't they?
I believe so, So
Doctor's going out on New Year's Day rather than on Christmas Day, which a lot of people are upset about. I think we talked about this last time, and it was possibly the BBC's like switching their focus for how they do drama and light entertainment over Christmas. And this has kind of snowballed into this whole thing of there not having been a Doctor Who Series 12 commissioned, well, not publicly commissioned anyway, up until a few days ago. Now, we spoke about this on the podcast a few weeks ago. And it now seems that the BBC has confirmed that Doctor Who Series 12 will air in 2019. Now, you might be thinking, well, it's December. How are they going to do that? Surely there's not enough time for a full series of 12 or 13 episodes. And you would be right. We believe that Series 12 has entered production, but it seems as though it will be a reduced number of episodes.
But that's not confirmed yet, is it?
That is not confirmed yet, no. However, there have been various rumours. Outpost Scarrow, for instance, claim that there will only be 5 or 6 episodes of Series 12, and it might be a split series, as in 2012.
Yeah,
Series 7 in 2012 was a split series, but with some episodes before Christmas, some episodes after Christmas. That could be a possibility. However, there's also rumours of the showrunner Chris Chibnall having only taken the job for 2 seasons, and Jodie Whittaker having said that she would only want to continue as the Doctor with Chris Chibnall at the helm. So there could be wholesale changes in store. Then again, we're looking at least a year into the future. And we've had occasions in the past where we thought we knew where Doctor was going on a production, production sense, and it's gone in a completely different direction. So it is really all up in the air.
I think it's also always that sort of thing, and I include myself in this, where for some quarters, you want the certain thing to be the case, so that somehow becomes something which becomes a little more shaped in news articles. I think it was the Outpost Skyro which was saying, because Jodie will probably want to leave because she's got a young daughter. I think it's, I don't know if it's daughter or son, actually, but has a young child, and being a young mother will want to spend time. And it's that sort of thing. It's like, well, it's not normally how the industry really always works. It just kind of feels like that's something that's in there because it's quite exciting or validating if you don't like the cat, don't like the Doctor.
Would anyone have said that about David Tennant?
Well, this is it. I know there's obviously a gender distinction where a lot of, I don't know, I would assume statistically probably more mothers take time off than fathers, even though I think that's changing. But I still feel it's kind of situated around this idea that people there's some quarters, especially Doctor Who fandom, which are hoping more for change, in the same way that I was hoping for change from Moffat. So it's, again, it's not an attack, it's just human nature. And it kind of feels a bit like that at the moment, that these are all a bit vague. But we'll see. Because, I mean, even if this was a situation in production where there might have been talk from Chibnall, even though there's been a lot of fan issues with Doctor Who since it's aired, in the ratings, it's still doing fairly well. That might be enough to encourage him, unfortunately, for some people to do another year. You don't know. And I think that's the problem, is that, you know, these pieces of news come from a moment of time, and it's an industry which is constantly changing. And what was thought about 5 weeks ago can be very different to how it is now. Yeah. So I think a pinch of salt.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, yeah, definitely. I think another piece of speculation was that Chibnall's doesn't really want to write another half a series.
Yeah.
That's another sort of something that's been kind of inferred by some of this. So, I mean, from that point of view, that might be a better idea. I mean, we've talked about this whole showrunner model in the past, and how the person with this ominous title gets to write half a series. And it seems utterly bizarre that such a load is put on one person, and also that more isn't done to bring more writers in. So, I mean, it might be a supply and demand issue. Maybe there are a lot of writers who don't want to write for Doctor Who or can't make scheduled to write for Doctor Who at a particular time. We've heard of people in the past dropping out, such as Stephen Fry dropped out, didn't he, early on, back in 2005. So, well, anyway, we're going to move on. With that, obviously, that will develop, and we will know more as the future.
It would be really interesting, actually, to see how the showrunner model has changed, or whether it has remained the same, where you'd get sort of very much in the early years where it was very much a planned out season, from what I recall, and then ideas were distributed, and then they were you. But the base ideas came from the showrunner.
Yes.
As far as I recall. Now, I'd be interested to know whether that shifted and changed. And obviously, we've had a lot more co-writing credits, which could be for industry reasons, sort of, I don't want to say ambitious reasons, but you know what I'm saying. Or it could be because that's changed in the way the showrunner works. So it'd be interesting to see if the model has actually changed in Doctor Who over 13 years.
I suspect, and obviously I don't know this, but knowing the characters involved, I would suspect Davies had more control over the show than Moffat and Chibnall have.
Yeah. But it's interesting
whether
as well,
directly, or whether he had a better working relationship with his immediate colleagues.
Well, I think yes, but then this comes back to the thing that Davis was a producer, which while Moffat wasn't, while Chibnall is obviously in a bit of a better position himself as well. But you kind of wonder whether the practices of one era inform the next, and the changes within the next inform the one after that. And so you get this sort of natural evolution of what the showrunner model is. And yeah, I'd be interested to see. I do think it's very odd, though, that the showrunner model has sat in the same way that, well, I don't know. Perhaps it hasn't, because while Davis used to do script edits, and that's probably somewhere in the showrunner model, which is quite which seems to suggest the Doctor Who is a very individualistic way of doing it. That the showrunner actually is the script editor as well.
Well, they had a script editor separate to Davies, although we know that Davies did work on scripts, but they also had a script editor. He must have had a slightly different job to that.
Well, I assume that I always assumed that the script. Well, no, I don't know. I don't know whether the script came to him, he edited, and then that went to the script editor, or the script editor did hit the pass, and then it went up the chain ready and to get signed off, and Davies then did edits. I imagine Davis did edits before the script editor. I'd imagine, if nothing else, there'd have to be sort of union reasons for that. Whether that model has changed. But the model seems to have always had this naturally powerful interference from the showrunner in individual episodes which are on their own, which feels, which is interesting. And it seems to have got more and more visible with the extra credits as well from Moffat's later era, which seems to be something Chibnall's picked up as well. It's like, is that a change in how it's perceived within the actual productions? Because I have no particular issue with Chibnall, but I personally would like to see a season which was less showrunner written. And I think that would be, I think that would be kind of nice, but yeah, maybe, I don't know. Yeah. Blair.
Okay. Well, let's push on. Kablam! It's I've just noticed. Maybe it's why I said it, but it sounds like one of those things that Alan Partridge would say.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Is the latest episode of Doctor Who series 11? It is episode number 7. It was written by Pete Mattei, who is a new name for a lot of people. Mattei's worked on Neighbours. He's a British screenwriter, but he's done a lot of work in Australia. He was the originating writer of Wentworth. And he has done a few other bits and bobs here and there. He's also he started writing on EastEnders in 2011. He's done a lot of stuff. He's come along with this Kablam idea of a sort of Amazon style delivery service with a problem. And so the Doctor and friends head there and try and work out what's going on. One of the things that's interesting me about this, and James and I haven't spoken about this already, so I have no idea what he thinks about this, and he's no idea what I think about this.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that I've noticed from the Doctor Who fans on Twitter in particular, particularly some names that you might have heard of, are tweeting things like, this is great, this is better, excellent Doctor Who, that sort of thing. Whereas maybe 2, 3, 4 weeks ago, they were very heavily defending it. And I wonder if, I kind of know the truth, but it's like a tacit admission that actually the other stuff hasn't actually been that good. And this was a lot more, I think this had that fun element, which I described last week, reinstated in Kablam that has been missing from the majority of things so far. How did Kablam hit you?
I must admit, I'm one of the few people who feels that it didn't blow me away at all.
Right.
I thought it was very good. I think what it did very well. I was thinking about this last night. It was, I would say, for what it was doing, it you'd give it a gold star. But I kind of felt I could have seen this in any era since 2005.
Mm-hmm.
I could have seen Capaldi in there. I could have seen Tennant in there. And I think some people would say, well, that's good, isn't it? Because that means it's doing what it should be doing. And I think that's what's getting to this. To me, seems to be a bit of a dividing line, which I think is perhaps causing some of the ripples. Is a question of what Doctor Who should be, and should be sort of infers a sort of like a future tense. But I still feel a lot of fandom, and this has always been the case with Doctor Who, it's about, and human nature as well, you compare it to what you've had before and see how that is how you try and measure its quality. Is this as good as what I remember being good? Mm-hmm. So you pick out what was good in the past and you go, does this match that? And for me, after 13 years of this, what I find sort of gratifies me is when I feel it's doing something I've not really seen it do. So while I'd say I think this had a better pace than a lot last week, which I really enjoyed, although I think, as I said, it got a little slow near the end, I preferred last week. To me, that was something more fresh and invigorating to the show. This felt like what the show's been doing for 13 years, but doing it extremely well. So in no way am I saying it was a bad episode. And there was some nice, very, very gentle subversions. It wasn't, while I don't think the show has been particularly preachy as people think it's been, I think Doctor Who in itself can be preachy just as a format. I thought it didn't overly focus on the questions of workers' rights, in so far as perhaps, I think someone mentioned on Facebook, as maybe what was it called? Was it Blind? What was the one with the space station where he lost his eyesight in Capaldi's era?
Yeah, I know the one you mean. Yeah.
Yeah, that one. It didn't feel quite so much about workers' rights as that. The characters were enjoyable. It wasn't, the twist wasn't that unsurprising, but it was still quite nicely played out within the story. It had a lot of Doctor Who elements, which I thought would make Doctor Who fans happy. There was a couple of references. I mean, if you throw in a reference to a previous era, I think you go up 3 points on a Doctor Who fandom Twitter scale. So I think the fact that there was a Fez in there was almost enough. And then there was a reference to Agatha Christie as well, and that must jump it up a star.
I didn't like the Fez, but...
Well, nor did I, but it just seemed to be something which just... You can see why Stephen Moffat ended up doing so much of it, because just by doing it just seems to get you extra positive publicity. and images across the internet. You know, suddenly within 5 minutes of the of it being released as Children in Need, that was all sort of memed and going through Twitter. And so you can see why sort of having a box, sorry, a pot of screwdrivers, sonic screwdrivers, you know, can be a boon. But yeah, and there was even a hiding in a cubbyhole, which is a very old school Doctor Who, sort of 70s Doctor Who. So I can see why people really liked it. And I'm kind of just glad that people enjoyed it. For me, like I said, I kind of missed something that I felt challenged me or challenged the show. But maybe it needed an episode which just showed it could do what it's done before well, so people could feel, okay, I can give this season a chance if I've not been enjoying it. Maybe there'll be more like this. So in that sense, I think it was good. For me personally, I was just a little less enthralled, but there we go. You liked it, or did you not?
It was fun, and it took it. I think it gave me enough to be thinking about as it went on, as to try and work out who was behind it. I did find Beardy Man was a little bit obvious. So I didn't think it was him, but I didn't guess it was the cleaning guy. So
no, nor did I.
So I think in that sense, in that sense of plotting out the mystery, I think it worked well there. The car park, I assume it was a car park that they used towards the end, wasn't great. There's a few elements of kind of, you know, that whole big vat of soup wasn't particularly nice. But without having any complicated social political history issues to discuss with the children, meant that I could put this one on. So it went down well with both of them. Which is rare, because my daughter doesn't often watch Doctor Who, but she seemed to enjoy this one. Bruce enjoyed it. And you know, this goes back to what we were saying before. There does seem to be a kind of this unevenness, a lack of focus perhaps, as to who the show is actually aimed at.
Yeah.
Which clearly isn't giving the show any problems, because the ratings are holding up. 5.93 million on the overnights for this one, which is a 28.5% share, which is, you know, it's around 30%, which is what it's been throughout. So, yeah, I think I'm glad people are enjoying it, as you say.
It feels almost like it's the inverse of the first season, where majority of the episodes felt like they're for kids, and occasionally you just get a spot one, like... I'm trying to think from the first season. I suppose it was The Empty Child.
Father's Day. Oh, The Empty Child, yeah.
Yeah, where they felt a little more adult. And obviously, certainly when you get to the second series and third, when you get Blink and the like, you suddenly get these pockets of ones which were felt for adults, but the rest were made for younger audiences. And now it feels a little more the other way around.
Mm.
Which is an interesting thing, because I kind of felt that the Moffat one was a little more sort of centred at sort of 20 somethings, more because that was the sort of thing which interested him. That sort of writing was what galvanized him. I didn't feel it felt like it was a demographic which felt was chosen deliberately. I could be wrong. I could be doing him a massive disservice. Davis, I felt, was a very deliberate choice of demographic. And I kind of feel that this might be a deliberate choice too, but I've never quite been sure what the rationale was, where, you know, statistically, where they felt this would be a good pocket to go for, the sort of teen and older. But it's an odd inversion of Davis.
Well, you know, it's Russell T. Davis was, of course, a children's TV writer.
Yeah.
And Stephen Moffat had worked on children's TV shows.
Yeah, Press Gang,
exactly, yeah, which I got on DVD recently. From the network sale. Whereas Chris Chibnall hasn't really. He's got a very heavy stage writing experience. He did a bit on Life on Mars and Torchwood, Law and Order, but, you know, he wrote Who Shot Simon Cowell for Ant and Dec's Saturday Night Takeaway.
He did quite a lot for Law and Order. He was quite heavily involved.
Oh, yeah, he was heavily involved in Law and Order, yeah. But, you know, he's written for Ant and Dec, and, you know, writing for Ant and Dec, apologies to my friend Dean Wilkinson, that is not a qualification for writing for Doctor Who, is it? So,
well, some would probably argue is why don't you a qualification for?
Well, yeah, but Russell T. Davies did a lot more than Why Don't You, didn't he? He wrote the popular children's hospital drama of the time, whose name completely escapes me. Oh, Children's Ward, yeah.
And then there's
those various BBC Wednesday evening dramas that he did as well. I think Davies had the. But yeah, so I think that maybe informs to some degree is, you know, where the writer's coming from in terms of maybe hitting a tone. Well, you know, maybe, you know, we used to hear a lot about tone meetings 15 years ago, 13 years ago on Doctor Who. You know, watching those behind the scenes on Doctor Who Confidential and all that sort of thing. And you don't get that.
But wasn't there meant to be writer's rooms in this? Didn't he say he was setting up writer's
rooms? Yeah,
well,
we keep hearing
rooms
about this, and you've mentioned it a couple of times. And, you know, week by week goes on, and it's like the word writer's room is never... doesn't appear to come anywhere from the Doctor Who production team anymore.
Because, again, this is less to do with the writer-producer, but as we've just been saying, the model of the actual show just feels that may be something that really needs changing. And to have the showrunner being, if you have to keep that title, being the producer, and to have someone who actually sort of runs as a sort of head story writer, and then a script editor as well. You don't have a sort of more classical hierarchy of creating a show, because it does feel very, because it almost feels like it's a very commercialized practice where it's sort of saying the showrunner, because a word that we have almost created, will be the person who sort of is the figurehead for the show. And because they're the figurehead of the show, there's got to be this sort of auteur notion that they've also got to be the sort of main artist behind the show. They've got to be the writer, the producer. You almost imagine them being on the set directing, even though they're not.
Yeah.
Possibly because director still carries its own sort of individualistic value within television to some degree. We don't expect that. But it's a very weird thing that we sort of expect the person to produce to be the one who writes or to be the author. And that seems to be how it's been set up. And it's a sort of weird, fake, commercialized model again, isn't it? It's not Doctor Who's... He hasn't created Doctor Who to be the one who has to produce and write it. It's already been created, so you don't need those two roles so sandwiched together. And I just kind of feel that means you'd have a producer who's a good producer, which maybe or maybe not we had as a difference between Davis and Moffat, depending on what your opinion is. And then you could have writers who are good writers, and both, you know, especially if we talk about Moffat and Davis again, both were very different but very good writers. I mean, I would still always argue Moffat was a far better writer than he was a producer. And that, to me, if he was a sort of like a head story writer and you had a producer keeping an eye on the show, controlling its tone, deciding on, you know, the market, and then the writer, head writer, actually working to that market and working to that mandate, you'd get the right writer in to do that. And it would, I don't know, it just seems more straightforward. But it's almost, again, like television is trying to sort of move up the stakes to that film notion, isn't it? You know, the film, it's not the producer, it's the director. You know, the director is the big auteur. He's the one that people look to and go, oh, this is a Spielberg film.
Well, that, you know, what you mentioned in film, that is very interesting that you mentioned that, because this episode is the one that didn't look like a film.
Yeah.
There's, in terms of, I'm not saying there's anything wrong with the direction, but the actual cinematography, there's no, you know, there's no sweep, no real sweeping vistas of landscapes or anything going on in Kablam. It's all very, almost all inside. And it feels like visually, you know, the scene, that kind of, that park location that they use for the rest area or whatever it was, like the staff room thing. I mean, that, it might even have been the same place. No, it probably wasn't. But, you know, it felt like the new Earth place.
Yeah.
You know, and it you know, there was nothing sweeping about. There's nothing stunning about the way it was filmed or anything. And then the rest of it's all internal locations and stuff. It kind of stands out from the rest of the series for that in that way.
I'd love to sort of write or produce an episode that was just called Retro. And you'd have them sort of landing in a 70s environment. So, and I was thinking, how would you do that? How would you make it feel like you were doing a 70s episode of Doctor Who without it feeling like you were trying to mock the 70s or just make it end up looking cheap? And I was thinking you'd have to buy in sort of things like 70s furniture
Yeah.
And sort of try and adopt the practices, but without it looking tacky. And I think that'd be really interesting. And then try and get the sort of, because I think it's something that Doctor Who doesn't do as much now as the old show used to. And that was obviously because it had, you know, obviously 90 minutes for an episode thereabouts. You'd have far longer pieces and bits with other characters away from the Doctor. So you'd actually get quite a few scenes with a villain. You'd get quite a few scenes with the characters who surround the plot, which you don't really have the space for. And especially this season, I was feeling there is a lot. There is a tendency where you, and I think Moffat's did this as well, where you really just follow the main characters through a story with very few scenes which break away from that to show you what others are doing. You know, just very minor ones, but it is very much you run with the characters. Mm. And you could, it'd be interesting just to see that done in a 70s way. So you'd have those cheap tables and maybe some, you know, bad furniture, attempts to make something look alien from going down to whatever the equivalent of IKEA was. And the music obviously would be different. Then you try and structure it so it would feel a little different as well. And it'd be just interesting to see how you could do that. And but you're right, this the reason I came onto that was because you were saying there is a very different feeling to this episode, which feels more like, as I say, more like maybe sort of New Who, early New Who, in that sort of sense that it's it does feel very, it doesn't have that cinematic scale to it.
I don't think that would stop it. I think there must have been a decision. Maybe it's something to do with the CGI, because there's a lot of CGI in this, isn't there? Maybe it's something to do with budgetary around keeping the CGI a bit narrower. I'm thinking of scenes like the interior of the warehouse when they're on the conveyor and all that.
Yeah, the conveyor was quite heavy. But I mean, I think also and I quite liked about the episode is that they tried to create quite a few variable areas, which of course, if you're doing a retro version, you wouldn't. But the the names are going out of my head. The heist in season 8, time heist, where you just recolored the corridors. There was a very clear attempt to try and give this moon a feeling of different stratas, as you say, and you have, which is to the point where you get to the bottom and it's just a car park. So I quite like that about it. Maybe because there were so many different sort of areas to it, it meant a lot of close, tight shots to try and make those areas work.
Yeah.
I imagine,
it did have a good sense of scale, didn't it?
Yes, it did. It did. Yeah. I mean, again, the one thing this season hasn't had for me, and I think it's actually probably good in a sense, but as I've said in previous podcasts, perhaps one of the reasons some of the speeches have not landed is that you just... there's very little. I don't really notice the music. Like I said, maybe that's a good thing. Maybe the music shouldn't be there as a character, as so often it has been under Murray Gold. But occasionally I do kind of miss looking for the music. But maybe I'm wrong. Maybe for others it has touch, but I just don't get the feeling that that's what it's intended to do here. Mm. But anyway, yes, no, I thought it was a really good episode.
Cool. Okay, let's hit Facebook and see what our regulars felt. Trevor Arthur, pretty decent classic story. Finally an episode where it makes sense to have the large ensemble of Team Tedious. Ryan is beginning to annoy me with his constant bleating, however. Jeff Waddell replies, that's the exact problem. He's irritating. And Yaz may as well not be there. Jeff Waddell initially said, better than what I feared, not as good as should have been. Now that's 7 episodes in and don't feel Jodie is good enough in the role, whether that's the writing or her acting. I'm guessing a bit of both. Wanted a villain of some kind. I think the villain in last night's piece, at least, is interesting in that we have a villain who's actually in the episode.
Yeah.
So there's that aspect to it. Obviously he's not doing villainy things, but I just, you know, I've said this before, we do need more villains in Doctor Who, and we need Doctor Who episodes that focus on the villains and not the companion's family/marital/job situation. Well,
this is why I was thinking of this retro episode, because my brain was thinking, I can't almost imagine a story where you have, you know, loads of scenes where the enemy are actually plotting or moving the story along in a sort of antagonistic way that we just don't really have.
Yeah.
And even when we've had them in the past a little bit, even in Davis eras, they were never...
It's only the classic monsters that get this treatment.
I'm thinking like Sound of Drums. By the time the Doctor's there, the situation's already set up.
Yeah.
So you don't get to see him set in the situation. You don't get that sort of counter melody to the Doctor's narrative, to the Doctor's storyline playing out at the same time, like you'd say get in Mind of Evil. Or
yeah.
That's the sort of thing would be interesting to see in this, and we don't ever see it. Yeah, I agree.
Okay, Andrew Brook, actually rather good. Fittingly for a story referencing 10 and 11, it felt like a New Earth story, except with an evil millennial instead of Macra. Two good episodes in a row, says Hamish Bell. Series 11 may be finding its feet. Much more safe Who territory, which kind of mirrors what you were saying.
Yeah.
Phil Vernon enjoyed it, despite some terrible acting by the guest cast. Owen Lucas, first episode that he totally enjoyed. Katie Poole, finally, great episode. Classic switcheroo, no teenies sermonising, good use of the Uncanny Valley, great Chekhov's gun, and best of all, Lee Mack was barely on screen for 3 minutes when he got deaded. I like Lee Mack. I'm moving on now. Philip Bates, never heard of him, says, first good episode of the series, decent scripts, slightly let down by dodgy performances. A writer who remembers that Yaz is police officer at last. Sally Jodie's overacting and doesn't feel like the Doctor at all. I thought this was possibly her best, actually.
Yeah, I thought she was good in this.
I do feel she's missing a defining moment. I do feel that... You know, I was watching... what were we watching? We were watching a Matt Smith episode a couple of days ago. And it was the one... It was Vincent and the Doctor. And I was watching that, I was thinking, he's not quite there yet at this stage, as, you know, the Doctor that he's going to be. And by the time he becomes the Doctor that he's going to be, remembering how old he was and everything, he really was fantastic.
Yes, he was.
He was an excellent Doctor. And I do feel Jodie Whittaker's some way from having that. Now, obviously, I can't quite recall what I thought when I watched Vincent and the Doctor and whether or not I felt Matt Smith was convinced me as a Doctor at the point or not. So... You know, it's very difficult to compare, but I do feel as if she's not... That there needs to be something more to her game as the Doctor. I think
for Matt Smith, for me, it wasn't until that Series 6... not Series 6. The six episodes, so I can't think what season it would be. 5, 6, 7? No, 7. Season 7, wasn't it?
Yeah.
It wasn't until season 7 that I felt there was a change in him. And the change was they started giving him... stuff which wasn't just quips, and then suddenly he started to find, and I think that just gave the actor something to not just make him more serious, but it gave him a sort of contrast so he could have fun with.
Yeah.
And he just seemed to come out a bit more, and that's why I like Time of the Doctor, is just by that point he's just so natural in that role. He can do the serious bits, he can do the soft bits, and his timing and his work with Coleman's just really beautiful in that. As we said before, you know, the rocket shaped ears or whatever, rocket fin ears, the way he sort of reacts to it, he's just got such a beautiful flow to it. And I think you're right. I think give her time. I think a lot of it's probably writing as much as anything else. I think sometimes they don't give doctors something which suits them in terms of dramatic acting enough that gives them a feeling of who the character is, to give them a feeling of how to fully play that character as a realized entity. And I think Matt Smith suffered from that. I don't think Tennant did, because I think by Tennant they had an idea. Tennant's very much an extension of where they were going with Eccleston to some degree, I think, possibly, maybe. The, you know, Eccleston sort of gets to the end of season one, starts to find someone, you know, understanding that having companions great, can move through the, you know, move forward. Tennant's a bit of that, so he's already got that sort of flow rolling on. But yeah, and again, McCoy is the same, isn't it? Well, no, McCoy's probably the worst example, because he's one who truly, there's no idea where he's going in that first series.
Yeah.
And then he's redefined for the second. I don't think she's anything like that, but yeah, I think you're right. I think sometimes it's trying to find that something's of substance to allow the actor to really, really ground themselves in that character, and then the writers see that and then they start replicating it. Yeah, they're just not giving her anything. I don't know. I mean, yeah, occasional speeches, which all doctors have of this, you will not do this, or I will come and destroy you sort of things. It's all fair, well and good. B- But you need something which maybe needs to be a little more personal, something which allows them to actually stop for a second and actually do a scene as if they were acting in Broadchurch or, you know, a serious drama. And I think Matt Smith suffered from that as well, that they didn't really give him anything other than speaking sort of eccentric Tom Baker lines, nothing that grounded him. Yeah, I don't know.
Yeah, it is. I mean, it could turn out to be one of those perennial mysteries of Doctor Who.
Maybe. And I think also it takes time for audiences as well. And while there's a natural, especially now, and it's nothing about being PC or woke or SJW, but having a change of gender in a Doctor, I think, like I've said before, we grow up with very specific beliefs of what is female, what is male, what is pink, what is blue. And I do think a lot of the issues that come from her is the fact that we have preconceptions of a male doctor, and now we have a female doctor who is not really playing a female doctor, is playing a doctor, which is great. But we still have our own conceptions of what women and men are. And I still feel there's this thing of that men give speeches and women lecture. There's that sort of thing that we have in society that we don't necessarily equate the same characteristics in the same way to gender, which is something we're slowly unraveling as a society, but not, you know, if you've been brought up that way for 30 years, you know, you're not going to unravel very quickly. And I still think we're being challenged by that a bit.
I'd have to disagree with that. I don't think you can. Women are well known for giving speeches.
I mean,
if we talk about how we're informed when we grow up, we have like male female parents or male female teachers. Is it the lady teachers that are giving speeches or lectures? Is it male teachers that are giving speeches or lectures?
But then we're talking about very much across the board there. But that's where the complexities come in, because there we're talking about women and men in specific roles where the roles themselves define the role more than the gender does. But if you look at how, I mean, I can't think where, but there have been things looked at in various areas about how we conceptualize the people doing the same thing, but we give different descriptors depending on their gender. I'm not saying anything mind blowing here. People have studied this. I wish I could think where I've seen this, but I do wonder whether that is the case. We do have a sort of kind of feeling that we do naturally. Gender does have an effect on us. And I don't think that there should be anything that shouldn't be shocking, because we are such a gendered society.
That's why we have such issues
with it. So I'm not saying that we're all just being naturally sexist. I'm just saying that we're brought up in ways to see genders do things in different ways, and we see crossovers, and that changes things. But I'm now sort of struggling because my brain's trying to remember the specifics I've said to sort of back this up.
Well, let's not put any weight on your brain. Let's move on to some more comments. Luke James, why this wasn't episode 2 or 3 is beyond me. That's a very good point. You know, if this had come along earlier in the series, we might be looking at a very different kind of general, you know, overall look at how people are seeing this in some ways. It does seem strange that it took so that it's come along late. The entire series could have a different feel. The only thing I can think of is it's got some, unless it was like a conscious decision just to leave it there, maybe it's got something to do with the CGI load on the episode.
Could be. Unless it's to do with the way they wanted to write, and by this point they wanted a more unified group. I don't know.
Yeah, maybe. Gary Akers says, second Chibnall-free episode, second great episode in a row. I'm sensing a direct correlation. For the first time this season, the Doctor is actually the leader of the group. That's interesting. I hadn't noticed that, but yeah.
What was that, sorry?
For the first time this season, the Doctor is actually the leader of the group. Now, we've spoken in earlier podcasts, previous podcasts, that she seems kind of subdued, or that she's not the leader, that it's very much a team effort, and she's very much in control in this episode. What do you think of that?
I found her in control in most episodes. I've not seen it myself, but obviously other people have, so or felt it's there. So I can sort of see what they see. Yes, I can sort of see what they mean. I suppose she does have a very proactive movement throughout the episode.
Yeah.
She's very much in control in it. Yes.
I wonder if that has an impact on how people have enjoyed this episode. People want to see the Doctor in charge, regardless of whether she's dressed as Moore or whether she's dressed as Toulouse-Lautrec.
But this is, again, this is
the Doctor discovering what's going on and fixing it and moving on.
But this is where I find, as I was saying earlier, the problem is that we tend to be looking back and sort of saying, this is what the Doctor, this is what the show should be doing. And it's a natural tendency for all of us to do that. But I do feel somehow that becomes too much of a line. And I'd like to hope trying to difference us out from other people. You know, when we all had issues with the Moffat era, there was very much a push for myself, you and Brian, to how the show could change to be different, not to be like it was, if you see what I mean. It was about trying to find things to repair it. And I do worry that there's a lot of talk. I'm not saying you here talk about this, but there's been a lot of talk about how to make it almost as it was. Where's it gone wrong? Why is it not doing what it used to do right? And I find that disconcerting. And I don't mind, to be honest, the dynamic of the Doctor stepping back a little. I'm used to it, I suppose, from the New Adventures or the early Hartnell era. And so it doesn't bother me particularly. And it just kind of means that when the person steps forward, it becomes more interesting. But just as another point of view, I guess.
Yeah. I wonder if that is one of those key things about Doctor Who, though, that it is difficult to get rid of without causing some, you know, if you move forward with it with a pared down Doctor Who, maybe one of the things that you need to keep is solving problems, as opposed to letting in everyone else solve the problems. Like get the bit by the teeth and find out what's going on. Maybe not. I don't know. Nick Caulfield, interesting nod to Robophobia during the episode. There are parallels to the big Finnish story of the same name starring Sylvester McCoy. Reminded him of the Happiness Patrol. I can see that, yeah.
Yeah.
I think some months from now, if I'm thinking of picking a standalone episode from this season to just watch, this one may be where my finger stops. Yeah. Rob Preston says Amazon bad. Andrew Brooke, come to think of it, weaponized bubble wrap was used once in NCIS. I'm a bit annoyed because I don't think I've seen that episode. So I'm quite frustrated by that. Nigel Webb says that the first 15 minutes had too much exposition, but the idea was a good one. Computer asking for help didn't see coming. There's a few good switches in this. However, the terrorist won, which is kind of right.
Yeah.
And I think we need to be very clear. This guy was a terrorist with, his plan was a plan of complete terror. So, yeah, at the same time, I mean, there is... You know, the Doctor said he wasn't an activist. He appeared to be working completely alone. So there's the whole lone wolf thing there. But at the same time, you know, there are examples in employment history, and I'm not an expert on employment history in the European Union or European countries, or indeed an expert in the UK. But I do know that there's a lot of campaigning and a lot of protesting prior to various changes to employment rights and things in the UK, and hours worked, equality, healthcare, wages. Although obviously wages came in a weird way because it was just, you know, flat fee for a lot of people of and unskilled jobs employed by large corporations. But you know, you wouldn't necessarily get a minimum wage if you were working on a building site because probably the constructor couldn't afford it. However, I digress. So, you know, you've got a terrorist who does that and then, you know, gets stopped. Yeah, okay, all the hardware gets destroyed. And then they go and change things anyway.
I suppose the argument would be, and it's a very weak one, I think, that the terrorist acts of terror didn't make the change. The change came primarily from a realisation from the characters in the show, and not necessarily to do with his ideology, but from from starting to see the company in a different way, or the way to work in a different way, because she was meant to be a people person anyway.
Yeah, yeah.
And then the lack of resources was the sort of practical motivator to do it. So, but yeah, I totally agree with what he's saying. It does feel on the surface, you could argue that somehow the terrorist got what he wanted.
Yeah.
Even though it wasn't through means of terror, he still got what he wanted. So in a sense, you can't argue against the fact, yeah, I guess he did win in that sense.
Yeah, yeah. Vincent Price? Christ, really? No. A Vincent Price has not watched it yet, but I'm sensing that the writing is the same thing. Okay. Well, next time, watch it, and then we'll maybe have some thoughts about your comments, Vincent.
Yeah.
Lots of Jonathan Roberts says a bit disappointed, but thought it was okay. But that's it. But generally, Paul G. Julie has I cannot pronounce usually Julie Hesmanal's name, so I'm not going to try.
Harsh.
Thanks. Eclipsed Jodie in every scene and illustrated what an actress with a screen presence could have delivered this season. Felt very similar to Beast Below. I always find that actress whose names I'm not going to attempt to be the same almost all the time. Not all the time, because I've seen her do, you know, proper, you know, that you know, proper, you know, pulling back the layers of, you know, of the human condition and proper deep, you know, fearful acting, all that sort of thing. Real pathos. And, you know, white knuckle stuff. But, in terms of this, she just felt very much like very many other things I've seen her in. And I think with such a distinctive face and voice, it's going to be very difficult to get around that. I think, obviously, Doctor's cast people with very distinctive names, faces and voices before, and it either works or it doesn't work. For me, I don't think it worked entirely, but, you know, I can't think of anyone to replace her with. So, but yeah, I think generally speaking, looking at the reaction to this from our Facebook listeners, and, you know, dear listener, you can leave us a comment on our Facebook page. Go like the page and you'll get an alert when we say, what did you think of that episode? Just leave your thoughts and we can maybe read yours out. Paul Fricker, for instance, simply said, best one so far. And I think that's generally a positive feel about this episode. Andrew Fairbrass, a sly but not subtle dig as sports director, was one of the few highlights for me of a very bang average episode. Felt like a Colin Baker episode, a jarring, unsubtle, brash 80s feel to it, and looked as cheap as chips as well. Warehouses are the new quarries, it seems, in these times of budget restrictions. I mean, yeah, there are points there that are worth considering, but I think as a unified whole, the overall reaction to this seems to be good. We enjoyed it. And I think that's kind of rare with season 11 so far, to have from our listeners on the Facebook page, because you, dear listener, may have a different opinion so far. You may have thought that was worse than thought that other episodes have been absolutely fantastic 10 out of 10ers, 11 out of 10ers. But yeah, I think it's refreshing to have people be a bit more excited about an episode and not trying to paper over the cracks with some interpretations of how it was or whatever, you know, just getting down to nitty-gritty saying this is good, this is bad, and this turned out well.
Yeah, I think it's in the end we all come wanting to enjoy something.
Yeah.
I just find it fascinating, we all come from so many different directions. And old Mr. Bates, who says, you know, sadly Jodie's overacting doesn't feel like the Doctor at all. To me, I don't really see that, but he does, and he genuinely sees that. It's not, you know, and other people have said that the guest cast, or someone else said the guest cast doesn't can't act. And again, it's like, I don't see that really either, but they do, and they genuinely see that. And it's a very fascinating thing where we're all watching the same thing and take so many different things out of it. But, Yeah.
Well, I mean, an actress like the one we were just talking about now, but having such a long career on a soap opera, being on TV like potentially three nights a week for weeks on end, I might have got the number of episodes wrong, but you know, I'm paraphrasing. Maybe that just distracts people when that person then ends up in another big show, you know.
Absolutely. I've always been against guest casting for that reason. I like to go in seeing something without someone I have preconceptions of. I thought Lee Mack did a great job in there for the little he was in it, and I thought he came across quite gentle and the character quite honest, but ultimately I was assessing him as Lee Mack. He was my entry into that character, and it shouldn't be like that. So, yeah, no, I do totally agree. It's a shame. It's the nature of the industry to get promotion and to be noticed.
I think it was probably, and you know, I love Lee Mack. I would pay to see Lee Mack. I've bought one of his DVDs. I like Lee Mack. I pretty much, you know, he always seems like a very down-to-earth guy. I don't think he would ever describe himself as an actor. He gets by on not going out by having a funny line every three lines.
Yeah.
You know, and that you know, papers over, again, to use that phrase, the lack of, you know, he can carry, you know, he can do a line, he can bring a line, he can do emotion and stuff like that. But his actual, like, his whole persona doesn't deliver that's like ideal of acting. I don't, you know, he can do the job, but, you know, he's not a great, unless a line is perfectly formed for him and there's a laugh at the end of it, it seems like he's very poor at delivering non-funny lines, basically. So, you know, there wasn't a lot of funny lines in there, but I think he did okay in Doctor Who, but I would rather watch him doing funny lines.
No, he was good in Doctor Who, but yeah, I mean, I enjoy him on Would I Lie to You.
Yeah,
I think where he is able to improvise fast, I think that's where his real skill set is. But at the same time, if I didn't know him from that show or his other work, I would have had no issue with him in that story.
Yeah.
I think he did good, but it's just frustrating when you know you're going in with guests in mind. And it's funny how important that is to shows for marketing to put that, as we've said before, that terrible piece at the end of the opener showing all this guests who'll be in the show, because they clearly felt, from a marketing point of view, that would draw people in. So you can see why industry sees, and probably rightly so, I don't know, how important guest, you know, your noticeable guest stars are to getting people to watch or feeling it's worth watching. I personally feel it just, yeah, gets in the way. And I've always felt that with the Doctor as well. I think the less you know of the actor beforehand, the better and more interesting it is to watch the performance, because you've got just nothing to play it against.
Matt Smith, for instance.
Yeah, Matt Smith's a really good example of that. I mean, to be fair, I'd never watched Casanova, so I didn't know Tennant beyond that.
I think the only time I'd ever seen Tennant, and I didn't realise it at the time, was in the first episode of Randall and Hopker Deceased with Reeves Mortimer. He was in that. He was the villain. So,
I found Eccleston probably one of the reasons I had issues with Eccleston initially is because I remembered him so clearly from Cracker.
Oh, right, okay. Well, I knew him from Cracker, but I also knew him from the other thing, the Derek Bentley movie. So, and I felt he was a very good actor. I thought he was having, you know, a someone recognised as a good actor as the Doctor. I thought that was amazing at the time. Because, you know, when you had rumours of, you know, Paul Daniels and Pamela Anderson and all sorts of nonsense like that in the TARDIS, and to get someone of Eccleston's standing as an actor in as the Doctor, that was like,
it was.
That said to me, this is a serious show. This, you know, we're throwing everything at this to make it as good as possible.
But that equally made it very hard for me, because I was so used to him being a serious dramatic actor.
Yeah.
And suddenly seeing him playing in a role where that wasn't what was important. It was, you know, it was a lighter show. Meant it, that clash was hard for me initially. I kept wanting to see the serious actor, and all I was getting was the, you know, the silly, light Doctor. So yeah, it can be a problem. And luckily for Whittaker, I totally forgot her from Broadchurch and Attack of the Block, so I went in fairly.
She was okay in Attack of the Block. I've always found her quite, She just never sold me in Broadchurch as anything other than the pretty blonde girl whose son was killed. So, yeah. Going back to Lee Mack, because I'm probably going to talk about something else in a minute, but if you, Not Going Out is one of those comedy shows that's run for a long time, has a kind of a mixed reputation, and it probably isn't watched by as many people as it was watched when a few years ago. Although, just scrolling through the ratings, it seems that the last series is probably one of the highest rated series of the lot. So forget that. But there was an episode in the last series. I think the early episodes are probably funnier than the later series. But there was an episode in the last series called Escape Room, which is entirely set in an escape room. It's a very good episode. And apparently was the best rated episode of that series. So, the second best episode rated of the last series. So certainly worth digging out if it turns up on iPlayer, because it's a good episode. Something hit me earlier. I've been watching another show, and then I've been watching Dot 2. And this is probably going to be the last thing we talk about, dear listener, by the way. There is a way of changing a show, and there's a way of not changing a show. And, you know, Doctor Who might have had quite a fundamental change at its core, not just with the Doctor, but obviously with the producer and the lineup of the dynamic of the Travellers and how some of the episodes work. But it seems to me that it can be quite easy to get wrong, even if you're not trying to get it wrong, even if things outside the show are affecting you. I've just hit Friends Series 7. And the first three episodes are like a drug-addled parody of the show. And it's completely unintentional. Because what happens is, there is an episode, there's like a finale in Series 6. And then the first episode of Series 7 falls on directly from that. Now, in the intervening time, actor Matthew Perry has gone into rehab.
Yeah.
And lost a lot of weight. At the same time, Courtney Cox has turned from quite attractive, slightly curvy lady, into some sort of like slinky supermodel. And there's like this, and David Schwimmer appears to be on blow. Because he's just like completely, like, he's been smoking. You know, he's very laid back. And then you've got Matt LeBlanc's Joey, kind of almost parodying himself by being ridiculously stupid. And you've got, it's almost as if the writing's completely been thrown by what's happening off screen. And you get these by the fourth or fifth episode, things are back on track again. But those first episodes are awful. It's really bizarre to watch. I had a nightmare about it. It hit me so hard. So I think, you know, we always have this problem with TV shows, these long-running TV shows as well, that, you know, things can just come along and scupper everything so easily. So maybe it's an argument for, coming from me, that's insane, for not taking TV shows too seriously.
Well, I think you could argue it's a reason to take shows seriously because it shows how complex they are.
Yeah. I think don't take the world that the TV show is giving you too seriously.
Yeah, I think so. But at the same time, I think what is interesting about television, and especially when you start studying it, is really less to do with actually maybe what's in the show, but how it's read by people outside the show. And how it's made by the people within the show. So what's actually on the screen becomes less interesting as the political dynamics, which, like as you say, with friends, which made that early ones in season 7 go so wrong, is fascinating.
Mm.
And so also it's equally like if we go to Doctor Who at the moment and questions of why this is diversive for fans, as was Stephen Moffat's, as was Davis, as was McCoy's. What makes those? What are the issues there? You know, what's causing these problems? I'm getting more and more fascinated by the gender factor, and you know, are the things within how we perceive genders affecting how we perceive Jodie? To say, Peter, if you swap them over in that show, would people find Peter Davison doing her lines any different, or would they not? I don't know, but it makes you wonder. And these are sort of things which I think which makes Doctor Who fascinating. It's less the story, it's more almost how the story affects us, and how it affects us affects how they produce the show. And so you get this sort of circular thing of this sort of us consuming it and then complaining or championing it, and how that affects the next season and how they write the next season. So it's just a really interesting little artifact. And so when people sort of say, and I know this isn't what you were saying, but they sort of say that, you know, it's just a show, you think, well, yeah, but it's not that that's interesting. It's everything around that, which is why we can talk about it for an hour.
Mm.
But the Friends thing is very interesting. But we see it in this show as well. You could see the issues where, you know, Jenna Coleman keeps going in and out of the show. She leaves and she comes back, and then she leaves and she comes back. You can see that there's a political thing going on behind the scenes there, where they're not sure whether she's leaving or not.
Yeah.
And how does that affect the story? Does it make the story better? Does it mean that we should just, you know, it's interesting stuff.
Yeah, it is. If you have any thoughts on any of that, dear listener, do get in touch. Those it on Facebook under this podcast, or get in touch on Twitter. We are Castor Beyond on Twitter. And we will be back next week, at least two of us. Until then, it's goodbye.
This is a Beyond Castor Brews podcast. Available on iTunes, Audio Boom, Stitcher.com, Player FM, and BeyondCastorBrews.com.